The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
It is my great pleasure tonight to welcome our guests, Richard Reeves and Jennifer Ouellette. Richard Reeves, senior lecturer at USC's Annenberg School of Communications, has written numerous works on American and world politics, and has won dozens of awards for his work in print, television, and film. In a slight departure from his political writing, Reeves' most recent book, A Force of Nature, The Frontier Genius of Ernest Rutherford, is a short biography of the physicist born on the frontier of New Zealand in 1871. Rutherford became, along with Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr, one of the most famous scientists of the heroic age of physics. Ernest Rutherford was teacher, guide, and mentor to 11 Nobel Prize winners. Using simple tabletop experiments with old copper and glass tubing, string, and sealing wax, he is now understood to be the father of nuclear physics, the second Isaac Newton, according to Einstein. Ernest Rutherford became the first man to split the atom, releasing the energy that would create nuclear power and the atomic bomb. All this from a kid born on the New Zealand frontier who built his first bicycle out of wood. Richard Reeves is best known for his trilogy on the modern American presidency: President Kennedy, Profile of Power; President Nixon, Alone in the White House; and President Reagan, The Triumph of Imagination. He is a syndicated columnist and former chief political correspondent of the New York Times, as well as a former national editor and columnist for Esquire and New York Magazine. This evening, in conversation with Mr. Reeves, is Jennifer Ouellette. She is the author of two popular science books for the general public: The Physics of the Buffyverse and Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics. She's a contributing editor of Physics Today. She also works with the American Institute of Physics Discoveries and Breakthroughs in Science TV project, and has covered science policy issues for the Materials Research Society. Her freelance work has appeared in Discover, Salon, Nature, Symmetry, and New Scientist, among other venues. And she maintains a general science and culture blog called Cocktail Party Physics. She holds a black belt in jiu-jitsu and has been known to draw upon that expertise from time to time to demonstrate the fundamentals of Newtonian mechanics. From February through April, she will be journalist in residence at the Kavli Institute of Theoretical Physics at UC Santa Barbara. This evening's conversation will conclude with a short question and answer period. We will have a microphone circulating, so please wait until the mic comes to you before you ask your question, as we record our programs for podcast. So now, if you would quickly check the nearest emergency exits and check to make sure that your cell phones and pagers are off, I would like you to join me in welcoming Richard Reeves and Jennifer Ouellette to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Welcome to all of you, and welcome Richard Reeves.
Thank you.
It's an honor to be asked to do this with you. I really enjoyed your book. I think a really good place to start is to sort of give the audience kind of an idea. Ernest Rutherford was probably one of the most famous physicists of his era, but he's kind of been eclipsed in recent years. So maybe we can talk a little bit about what he did and why it was so significant, and maybe a little bit about, you know, why no one seems to remember suddenly who he is.
What he did was invent nuclear physics. He was born on the frontier and was the first research student admitted at Cambridge who did not go to Cambridge. He was from New Zealand, and they treated him like a hick. And he remembered that most of his life. Actually, in New Zealand, totally unknown, he had developed radio waves, wireless, farther than Marconi had. But when the Curies, Marie Curie, found radium, most of the action turned to radioactivity as a way to find out what the universe was made of. At that time, it was believed that atoms, which is the Greek word for indivisible, were like little billiard balls. So after discovering half-life and challenging Lord Kelvin on the age of the Earth, Rutherford established the age of the Earth. And the New York Times, on its front page when that happened, the headline was Doomsday Postponed, because he found out it was many millions of years, hundreds of millions of years older than Kelvin had thought. He then discovered, essentially, his greatest discovery in the experiments that I recreated was the atom as we know it today, the small nucleus, as he described it, a fly in Westminster Cathedral, which is the approximate size, surrounded by or orbited by negatively charged electrons. And then in one of the great science stories of all time in the 1930s, when five teams from three nations were racing to split the atom, the two American teams under William O. Lawrence at Berkeley and another at Caltech, the Germans, who had two teams, as it were, in the field, and Rutherford, who by then an older man, with young assistants at Cambridge, the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge. And despite the fact that in his second inaugural address, Bill Clinton listed among the American accomplishments of the century splitting the atom, in fact, it was Rutherford who split the atom at Cavendish in 1933. He won his Nobel Prize in 1908 for work he had done at McGill in Canada, but he did 11 of his students, most notably Niels Bohr, also won Nobel Prizes. And he was the greatest experimental, big, clumsy, loud, boisterous man. At high table in Cambridge, a New York Times reporter asked, why did they sit me next to that Australian farmer? And they said that Australian farmer is Lord Rutherford, who at that time was as famous or more famous than Einstein. And in one of the last great acts of his life, he formed the committee and headed it, which brought 1,500 physicists, including Einstein, out of Germany before the Nazis got to them. He died in 1937. He had never taken out a patent, and he had £7,000 in the bank. The $7,000 he had won for a Nobel Prize, £7,000 he had won for a Nobel Prize in 1908.
Mm-hmm.
A great man.
Yeah. I'd like to kind of redirect and maybe have you go into a little more detail of this pivotal scattering experiment that he did that kind of helped prove the structure of the atom, that it was not, in fact, an indivisible thing.
I've spent most of my life writing about politics and history, in fact, was educated as an engineer, and when they asked me, would I do this book as part of the Great Discovery series, I said I would if they would let me repeat Rutherford's scattering experiments, which I did in a lab at my college, Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey. The scattering experiment basically was that Rutherford discovered the alpha particle, which was the turned out to be the nucleus of hydrogen atoms, and came up with the idea of using it as a rifle to try to break into matter to figure out how matter was constructed. What was going on in this heroic age was you had Einstein looking out to see what the universe was and where it ended, and Rutherford looking inward to try to figure out what we were made of. This table, all of us, those chairs. He had done some early experiments in shooting alpha particles through, it was like a gun, a lead box with a small slit, through various materials, from the heaviest gold to the lightest lithium, to see what would happen and what would make of it. And it should have, if the theories of what the atom was by then, we're talking the early 20th century, were true, all of those particles should have gone straight through and formed a line inside this small cylinder. The whole apparatus was about this big. Through the small cylinder and leave an exact mirror image of the slot through which they emerged. But he had noticed at McGill that there was a fuzziness. He would often do several things at a time, and like most scientists, he failed 100 times out of each 101 experiments. There was a fuzz, and when his lab assistant, who was Hans Geiger, who invented the Geiger counter out of these experiments, they had a 19-year-old student named Ernest Marsden, who later became the greatest of Australian physicists, said, why don't you have, Geiger said, we've got to give young Marsden something to do. And Rutherford said, why don't you have him find out whether there are, they would look into this apparatus through a microscope, whether any alpha particles are falling outside the tiny range we picked. And when he did that, they found out that they did come out at different angles, and that one in every 8,000 times, they would come almost straight back. It was not so much collision. We call it collision, but it actually was electric repulsion. And as he said at the time, this is 1909, that I've never seen anything like this in my life. It's as if you fired a shell from a 15-inch cannon, which was the largest weapon of the time, at a piece of tissue paper, and it bounced back at you. For 2 years, he thought about that. He was a slow thinker. He thought like a battleship. And at a Christmas dinner in 1913, he looked up and said, I know what the atom looks like. And Charles Darwin's son, who was at the table, wrote that down. And the next day he went into the lab and drew and began mathematical formulas for the atom as we know it, the nucleus surrounded by spinning electrons. And with the what's in the nucleus and what's in the electron determine what material it is. He also was the world's first successful alchemist because he did indeed not lead into gold, but he was the first person to realize that elements could evolve into each other.
And I'd like to talk a little bit about how you went about recreating this. I mean, in your book, you make a point of saying that Rutherford was one of the last great tabletop experimenters. He used, you know, small handheld devices. He used copper. He used sealing wax. And I think we sometimes think of science as being this sort of pristine, esoteric thing, but he worked in a freezing basement. You know, when you did this, you had to weld things and build things, and it was as much construction as anything. And you ran into some problems as well. There were just some things that have changed.
Well, a lot of things have changed, and I was involved. I learned to weld in the same room as another Stevens graduate, Alexander Calder, though he made a better use of it than I did. But we did well. we did recreate with one advantage and one disadvantage from scratch an experiment which was larger than his for particular reasons. And the two biggest differences were that by 2005, when I did this experiment with the head of the physics department, Kurt Becker, and two graduate students, you could pull an almost perfect vacuum, certainly a lot better than Rutherford and his people would do with essentially foot pedal pumps or hand pumps. On the other hand, he could use radium. In fact, he carried it around in his pocket. At McGill, there was a desk called a $10,000, $100,000 desk, because that's how much it took before they put it in a museum. He would come home at night and toss the radium into the drawers of that desk. It took $100,000 to clean it up so anyone could go near it. So that while we could get a better vacuum and less chance of random collisions that would distort the results, on the other hand, you can't carry radium in your pocket anymore. And a lot of it was negotiating with the government over what radioactive material we could use and how much of it. And we used americium, which ironically had been found by Lawrence, one of the competitors in the race to split the atom. But the biggest problem was dealing with the government and how much radioactivity, because there were factors of billions in the number of alpha particles that shot out of his little experiment, and ours was a much smaller number, so that you sit in the dark for a long time in the hope of seeing. You can't see, obviously, an alpha particle, but you can see scintillations. And zinc sulfide, by painting the inside of the vacuum chamber with oxides, you can see sparks that where it hits, and that's how he had seen that first fuzz. Mm-hmm. It was the greatest thing. My two roommates in college at Stevens, we were all lab partners. We were friends and lab partners. And my job was not to go in the lab because I would break anything that I got near, but I could write a hell of a lot better than they could. And one became Dave Azzetti, became head of the Department of Physics at the University of Chicago, and Danny Martiri became the head of the chemistry department at Georgetown, and I really did this to prove to them that I wasn't as dumb as they thought I was.
Did you actually see the scintillations?
Yes.
What was that like?
Pretty thrilling.
Yeah.
One of the graduate assistants said to me, you get to know each other very well in this kind of experiment, as Rutherford got to know a lot, because you have to sit in the dark for a very long time so that your eyes can pick anything. And Frank Corvino, who was one of the graduate assistants, spoke with me who ran the experiment. And but the last words he said after we had done all this talking back and forth about what physics was like then and did... and we talked about lab technicians and how much contempt they had for physicists. Spent a lot of time talking about a fellow we all knew called the Nine Finger Wonder, who had tried to fashion an experiment of his own and cut off his pinky, which physicists do things like that. But Frank's last words before we finally put our eye to the opticals was, let's see God. And that's what you do when you look in. That's what Einstein did. That's what Rutherford did. That's what Niels Bohr did. They totally changed the world and the way we see it. Mm-hmm. And we saw God. Yeah. They better than I. Their eyes being a bit younger.
One of the things I really loved about your book was there have been prior biographies of Rutherford, scientific biographies, but I thought that you really nailed Rutherford the man in a way that I hadn't encountered, that really surprised me. And I was curious as to how you go about writing a definitive biography of such well-traveled ground, and also, was there anything you discovered that surprised you?
Well, part of the well-discovered ground, of course, that's your background. you're working with that. But he's the most famous son of New Zealand, and he's celebrated greatly in New Zealand. And it was a time when people wrote letters. And first to his mother, and then his fiancée, and then his family. He was an extraordinarily energetic and big man who would write letters. So that the letters, plus there is no one who ever worked with him who did not write a book about him. Every single person, because he was such a mentor and such a groundbreaker. And what the surprising thing then was, for someone with a scientific education, at least, if not being very good at it, was to find out that Rutherford, who was as famous as Einstein in his time, he was the great experimenter looking in. Einstein was the great theoretician looking out. Einstein worked with a paper and pencil. It was Rutherford who proved that E equals MC squared in 1933. It had been posited by Einstein, but never proved until then. And the amazing thing then to me was that Rutherford is almost totally forgotten in the United States, partially because Einstein came here and was a great character and was seen as kind of the Pope of science. Second, that was the point at which hands-on, the kind of Rutherford experimentation ended, and you now have the new cyclotron in Switzerland, which is as big as a medium-sized city. Rutherford's experiment, the first time he chipped off an atom, it looked like a music box, was about like this. But it was then the Germans were eliminated from the field, though, as I said, Einstein, Rutherford was responsible for getting 1,500 physicists out of Europe in that period. When Einstein moved to America, to Princeton, science, the imagination of science, moved, and Rutherford died shortly. Rutherford died in 1937. And America had the money to do this new kind of massive science. Rutherford's last triumph was splitting the atom, even though the entire area around the Smithsonian Institute was filled by a single mechanism that American scientists were using to try to split the atom. Their big problem was insects getting into the thing, but it was as big as the Smithsonian. The apparatus was as big as the Smithsonian building itself. And the big surprise was that Rutherford, whose every word was on the front page of the New York Times when he was alive, is now, except for scientific people, as far as I could tell, almost totally unknown, partially because he died at the wrong time and partially because science then moved to another phase. One of the other great surprise was that the three giants of the time, Rutherford, Einstein, and Bohr, as far as I could tell, all lied deliberately about whether nuclear fission was possible and whether it was possible to control it. And as far as I could tell from their notes and whatnot, those three men all knew that it was possible, but deliberately set out to deceive governments and whatnot because they knew what the atomic bomb would be. There were, after he, in the 1920s, Rutherford said, we're working with stuff that some damn fool in a laboratory could blow up the entire world. And Einstein also talked that way. And they, as far as I can tell, deliberately tried not to hold the scientific knowledge from scientists, but to hold it from political leaders, who at that time included Hitler, mm-hmm. who is another student, Werner Heitz, had been a Rutherford student, as had been Oppenheimer, and anyone who counted in the Heisenberg, Werner Heisenberg, who was a relatively enthusiastic Nazi. Hans Geiger became a Nazi, and he was the one who picked the Jewish scientists to be decommissioned, as it were, the same scientists that Rutherford was sneaking, including Bohr, who was in occupied Denmark, was sneaking across the channel to England and then to America and eventually to Los Alamos.
That raises another interesting point in your book. Particularly later on in the book, you basically talk about how war came to science, and it ripped that nice little boys' club apart, that nice collegial...
It both ripped... War is great for science, because when war comes, governments will pour any amounts of money into science, and so that's the upside for it. Of course, what you've got to do is find things that will kill people or destroy things, but a lot of things that happened would not have happened. Rutherford also developed sonar, and along with, at the same time working, without knowing it, the fellow who lived across the hall from him in Cambridge, Pierre Langevin, the great French physicist whose career was kind of destroyed, as was hers, when it was discovered that she was a widow by then, that he was having an affair with Marie Curie. These were real people. And the actually, you could do a whole book on Einstein, and some people have. But when they were asked, I mean, this guy was like a cowboy, and he dressed like a cowboy. And when he was first there, someone asked Langevin, what is this Rutherford like? And he said, Langevin said, how do you describe a force of nature? So that the title of the book, A Force of Nature, comes from that quote, and also from the fact that the great force of nature is what holds the nucleus of the atom together. And it was the unleashing of that unleashed the greatest force we know in nature. I wonder if I can, let's see, my own notes, what these people did. There was, in 1936, which was a year before Rutherford died, there was a piece by the chief science writer of my old paper, Waldemar Kempfert, who really was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant physicist, as other writers are, as many, right? The thing is, they can do everything we can do, but they then also know this other language, another world, which is totally inaccessible. But this is what they did, according to Kempfert, in 1936. Suppose that no one on earth had ever heard a piece of music. Then suppose that Beethoven's Fifth Symphony is played over and over again by invisible musicians. The physicist's problem is to devise an apparatus which will sift out one note from another and analyze it, infer what kind of invisible instruments produce these sounds, deduce the rules followed in determining what note should be played, and how long and how loudly. And that's what this small group of people did, not with Beethoven's Fifth, but with life itself. And that's why it was the heroic age. They were genuine heroes who, all of them a bit odd, but wonderful.
You had a wonderful line in your book talking about Rutherford's genius for seeing things, and I don't know what it was exactly, but it was something about how, for him, he always looked at the margins.
In the scattering experiment, it was the margins. When you're scientifically trained, really, which is a wonderful education, even though I was no good at it, but I was a Sputnik child, and if you were from a large public high school in a poor city, which I was, they put you in scientific education because of Sputnik immediately. And what you learn to do, which carries you through life and whatever you do, is to isolate the variable, to find out what is the one thing that its changes make. Rutherford was a genius at doing that, and he lived off aberrations, like, why is this line fuzzier? Something we don't know about must be happening. Sometimes he was right, almost always, but sometimes he was wrong, and it would take hundreds of experiments through the nights, through the days, to prove whether these things were true or not, including, as I said, did E actually equal mc squared? In 1933, when Rutherford Cockcroft and Walton, two of his students, split a lithium atom in the first one. When they found, and then they weighed all of everything left, and it had lost a slight bit of weight, therefore must have been turned mass and energy, we now know being the same thing, that they then worked out the formula that described how much energy had been produced by that loss of mass, and that was E equals mc squared. The energy equals the mass. It is proportional to the square of the mass.
Quite possibly the world's most famous equation.
the only one anyone knows.
Yeah. I want to talk for a moment about the mentoring. For many years, I was with the American Physical Society, and one year around the time of their centennial in 1999, they held a genealogy contest of young physicists tracing their advisors and their mentors throughout, and whoever had the longest line would win.
Right.
And among physicists, invariably, it was J.J. Thompson and Ernest B. Rutherford.
Right.
You mentioned his...
J.J. Thompson was the head of Cavendish Laboratory when Rutherford came there as a student.
Right.
And then Rutherford... Thompson didn't actually want to quit, but Thompson said one of the great honors of his life was to turn over the world's greatest laboratory to the greatest student he ever had.
Right. And also who carried on his tradition of this mentoring. I mean, one of the biggest impacts I think Rutherford had in addition to his research was the young physicists that he turned out. And we're still feeling that today.
Yes.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about who some of those people and how they had a very real affection and devotion and loyalty to Rutherford, and he inspired that in them despite being a little mercurial at times.
Well, he, I suppose, you know, Freud is better at this. Rutherford had only one child, a daughter, who died tragically, and it was felt that all of his proteges, as it were men, except he also worked with Lise Meitner, the great, the Austrian physicist, a woman, who discovered nuclear fission, or who proved that it was possible. She did it while she was living in a one-room apartment in Stockholm because she was half-Jewish and had been driven out of Austria. And then the Allies, I'm going off a little bit, but these people lived these lives. The Allies brought in Niels Bohr, snuck him back into Europe to try to talk Lise Meitner to come to Los Alamos. And she said, I don't want to work on weapons. And she lived out her life in poverty. I don't want to work on weapons that will kill massive numbers of people, which of course they could. Among the more interesting of his students was Harry Moseley, who many thought would be the greatest scientific mind of the century. And Moseley was killed at Gallipoli when he was 22 years old. And Rutherford said, if nothing happened but Moseley's being killed, it shows what the real tragedy of this war is. So they were, and some worked out. Oppenheimer had a lot of psychological problems, was not a great student in his Cavendish years, and the greatest of them was Bohr, who was, and they didn't want to bring in Bohr. No one could understand him when he spoke, and they couldn't understand when he wrote either. His first language was Danish, and the committee at Cavendish said, well, why should we take in this young man? He was then young, and you know, he's odd, the thing. And Rutherford's answer was, no. Bohr is all right. He plays football, meaning rugby at that time.
Yeah. He's a real man.
He was also a terrible teacher. At one point when he was teaching at McGill and the American universities, Yale, Columbia, were trying to get him, but he wanted to go back at England, the dean, who oversaw the general scientific thing, said, you know, he sat in on a Rutherford class, and he said, that was a wonderful lecture, and the integral calculus is certainly a valuable tool that these young people can use, but don't you think you should wait until after you teach them algebra before you. And he was one of the great absent-minded professors. And when he would discipline or try to discipline students, they would have to leave, and they then all knew to wait 3 or 4 minutes and come back in. And by then, he had forgotten totally. But I wasn't lucky enough to get professors like that. But it was inspiration, was the, you can do this, keep working at it, God damn it, give me results. And he had this huge booming voice. One of the famous pictures of him in here is standing in his own laboratory with wires and wood everywhere. When they split the atom, dark room they use, as we sat in the dark room 70 years later, or whatever number of years later it was, 90, I guess, it actually was a tea crate, exactly the same tea crate that were thrown into Boston Harbor, the tea that was shipped from the India to England, and they put a black curtain in front of it. It was his inspiration of other people that ended all his results, not what he taught them. They were all, though you wouldn't know it looking at him, they were all geniuses. A genius being someone who changes the way you see the world, a Picasso, a Freud, a Rutherford, an Einstein. And it was his constant prodding of them, although his methods were very old-fashioned. This famous picture shows him standing under a sign that says, "Talk softly, please." And that sign was put there because he had a beaker-shaking voice if he talked. He also, when the BBC for the first time broadcast live to the United States, Rutherford being the most famous scientist and one of the most famous citizens of the empire, gave an address as the first broadcast. And when they were told at Cavendish, by then he was a baron, Baron Rutherford is going to give the first speech from here to America, they said, "Oh, will he need a microphone?"
I guess that answer would be no.
No.
We had talked a little bit backstage about another aspect of Rutherford, which is that he championed women and minorities, and this was very much ahead of his time, and you mentioned that he very much felt the classism of England, and that because he came from rough roots, that I think he was maybe a little more open to people who maybe didn't fit the
elite structure. Well, I think, actually, he judged people by their scientific talent, and one of the things that happened after World War I was that the German science was destroyed, the infrastructure of German science, including the buildings, and to say nothing of the people, was destroyed. And also you had, after these 4 years, again, you had the same thing after World War II, this tremendous, this mass of people who wanted an education, who had begun educations and then had them interrupted by the war. And places like Cambridge and Cavendish, the lab, were just overwhelmed with these people, many of them Americans, because for the first time, American science had begun to reach the level of European science. And so that the solution that Cambridge came up with was that they would admit no more women so that there would be enough space for the veterans coming back. And Rutherford famously, in a letter to the Times of London, said that if they deny any woman a place at Cambridge, I will leave England. And that was the end of that. And he was a great champion of both Marie Curie, who was incredibly persecuted by the men of science, who even to the point that it was her husband who first got the Nobel Prize, Pierre, for work she had done, because they would not believe a woman could do this, and the other being Lise Meitner, who, as I said, you should write a biography of this incredible woman. But Rutherford, who was oblivious to things, when he first met Lise Meitner, said, "Oh my God, I thought you were a man. No one told me you were a woman," although she later worked for him.
Right. Well, I'm going to we can talk another 5 minutes or so, and then we're going to take some questions. But I do want to get to how the world has changed since Rutherford. I mean, we've gone from his small tabletop experiments to the big science. And more importantly, we've gone from the age of physics to what some people are calling the age of biology. And I find that especially ironic because Rutherford has that famous quote,
right.
Everything is physics. You know, if it's not physics, everything else is stamp collecting.
Right.
That includes chemistry, biology, right. and all these various
right.
things.
And, of course, physics, which was called natural philosophy originally, at the turn of the 19th century, not the turn, in the year Rutherford was born, in the Encyclopedia Britannica, there were 100 pages on chemistry and not a word on physics. It was considered a soft science until people like Rutherford proved that you could use it, that it was, in fact, the mother of sciences, as it were, to do. And it at that time, even a kid working at Canterbury University in Christchurch, New Zealand, and teaching school at the same time, was able to create experiments that changed the world. And to give you an idea, the most famous person in all of these labs, if you read in the book, nothing has changed, by the way. The machinist talking about nine-finger physicists. But when Rutherford was at Cambridge, there was a man named Lincoln who was the lab technician, who was notably rough on experimenters and cheap. And so when Rutherford had to ask for the first time for equipment, usually in those days and now, the equipment is cannibalized. One of the great things about doing this book was that when Rutherford left McGill, a young physicist there realized we won't see his likes again, and in the 30s locked all of his experiments in a storeroom under a staircase, and they were not opened for 60 years, and his original equipment was sitting there. It's a very exciting thing to step in there and to see it. But when the time came, for instance, to split the atom, the amount of electrical power you needed to do that, again, this is the greatest force of nature that you're trying to separate, it took enormous amounts of electricity, and you went from the days when Mr. Lincoln, the lab technician, when Rutherford first wanted to make what amounted to a little barrel to shoot out alpha rays, said he was very afraid of Mr. Lincoln, but finally got the nerve up to say, I need a barrel made which has a diameter between thus and so. And Lincoln said, oh, it's fine. That's not a problem at all. Rutherford, oh, my God, he's not the monster they told me he was. And Lincoln pointed out into the courtyard, and there was a bicycle resting there. He said, cut off those handlebars and make it yourself, which indeed he did. But then it moved to an area. It literally moved from that kind of science within a very short period of time to Los Alamos, where you had thousands of physicists and tens and hundreds of millions of dollars to try to do one thing. We know what that one thing was, but it was, in the end, only one thing all of those people were doing. The soldiers, one of the great stories of the soldiers there, they all had pseudonyms, and everybody only knew a part of things, and there was the American soldiers who were in charge of military guards, when this new scientist with a heavy accent spoke very slowly, appeared, and they were told that his name was Nelson Baker, but they noticed that everybody treated him with this incredible deference, and would not do anything without talking to him first. And the Americans said, who the hell is this guy? And Mr. Baker was Niels Bohr.
I want to talk very briefly about Rutherford's death, essentially, because you had mentioned in back that for a while there was quite a bit of mystery surrounding that. His wife, she was very religious, very severe and strict, and not necessarily well-liked by his colleagues, kind of the antithesis of her husband.
Right.
really kind of locked down on some of the information about that. So maybe we can talk a little bit about how this great force of nature, this powerful man with the big personality and the booming voice, left the planet.
Well, he was, his wife, one of the things about, there were early biographies and whatnot, but Lady Rutherford controlled anything that was released for a very, very long time. That probably is one of the reasons he's not as well known, because it's only been the last few years that a lot of the work he did has been released, from mainly from the Library at Cambridge, but also at Canterbury and Christchurch, because his wife, just like dealing with presidential libraries, his wife had held that down, and there was great mystery about his death. He had died, he was pruning a tree in his yard. He was 66, and he was as strong as he ever was, but not as agile, and he fell out of a tree. He fell out of the tree that he was pruning, and he then began to vomit, and pain grew greater and greater. And his wife, who believed in a lot of folk medicines, brought in a masseuse to try to work this out. In fact, he had a strangulated hernia, which killed him. The infection from it killed him. Before they brought doctors down from London to work on him, infection had already set in. And that, she did her best to keep that. She's very defensive about that piece of information, and she used his last assistant, James Chadwick, a Nobel winner, who discovered the neutron, although he discovered it 13 years after Rutherford had concluded it has to exist. The neutron is the key to nuclear fission because it has no electric charge and therefore is not repelled by either negative charges or positive charges. And Chadwick finally released his correspondence with Lady Rutherford, in which she talked very defensively about it. It wasn't my fault. Chadwick also was an interned alien in World War. People are interesting. In World War I, and the British detainees were held in a racetrack outside Berlin, and there were eight of them to each horse stable they were kept in. And Chadwick, who was a great scientist in his own right, did a series of experiments which led to his discovery of the neutron. And the way he did it was that radium, no one knew the dangers of it then, was so popular. It was used in advertisements. It was used in toothpaste. And he used radium-laced toothpaste at the camp to do some significant experimenting, and the toothpaste, it was Geiger, later the Nazi, who would bring him the toothpaste and other small bits of material that, being Rutherford trained, he could do almost anything with.
Right. I'm going to open it up to questions. We're going to have someone come around, right down here in front, please. Because I know I'm sure a lot of you have a lot of questions. This is a very rich, deep topic, and we could probably sit here and talk all night.
You spoke about Rutherford in 1933,
right,
and the splitting of the atom. 25 years ago, David Wilson wrote this biography of Rutherford,
right,
and there's a quote in there. I wonder if you could comment on this. Thus, in a sense, it was Marsden who first split the atom as early as 1914. But he had no knowledge of what he was doing, and it was Rutherford who saw what was happening, who understood and explained the process, who provided the evidence proving the case, and who was first, deliberately and knowingly, to smash an atomic nucleus.
Right. The Wilson biography of Rutherford is, as I mentioned in here, is the standard, where I think it was 1980? It was the standard work. One of the things that happens in science is that people, including Rutherford, who split the atom without knowing it, and Otto Hahn, who had worked with Lise Meitner, who created nuclear fission, or first created in a laboratory, but didn't know what had happened. And often, what is it, the was it vulcanization was an accident of something falling off the table? The X-rays were discovered by Röntgen, which led to a lot of this, because he had left some photographic plates. He had radium in his lab, left some photographic plates in a drawer, and when he came back, the film had been developed. It had been developed by the radium. That many of the breakthroughs in science either were accidents, or had been done by someone without knowing what they had done, and then comes along someone else who understands, this is the argument for open publication, who looks at the lab results and says, no, this is what happened, that's what happened. But there was Rutherford also before 33 had done nuclear fission without realizing that he had. But that was the previous book, the previous definitive biography was by Arthur Eve, who was also a student of and a great physicist, as, by the way, among his other students were C.P. Snow and Chaim Weizmann, both each of whom had other interests at the time, but Weizmann was a great scientist. But that was the first one. Eve's book was totally controlled by Mrs. Rutherford, and it was the letters of Ernest Rutherford, but they were the letters that she wanted published.
Okay,
and then Wilson spent years doing this.
This gentleman over here, and then we'll get to you next.
Could you explain a little bit what the model for the atom or matter was prior to Rutherford that led to the expectation of the cannon
right
going through the tissue paper?
Right. Up through classic physics, up through Isaac Newton, believed that the atom, as I said, was the building block of nature, I guess you'd call it, but it was believed to be indivisible. That's what the word means. And that it was, for as Rutherford said, I was taught that it was like a little billiard ball, red, green, or yellow, depending on your taste. J.J. Thompson had discovered, who was in a very real sense Rutherford's mentor, had discovered the first subatomic particle without knowing what it was, with the electron, the tiny negatively charged electron. And at that time, from that discovery, was posited what was then and now known as the plum pudding model of the atom. That is, that they knew that the atom was electrically neutral. And when Thompson discovered in vacuum this, you're never able to see it, and hard to describe it, they switched to what was called the plum pudding model, which was neutrally electric, and the plums, the pudding was kind of a mass of positive charge, a kind of, I noticed the review of the book last week in the Toronto Globe and Mail, or the Globe and Mail in Canada, said from a spongy blob to modern science. They believed it was this little blob of for a few years after Thompson's discovery, was this blob of positively charged mush with bits of plum in it, which were the negatively charged electrons. And it was that, although that model of the atom, how long? That probably about 10 years?
Yeah, very short in a scientific time scale.
Yeah. And Thompson himself, again, didn't quite know what he had come up with.
You had a question?
Yes. First, Jennifer, I love your website.
Oh, thank you.
Just discovered it a couple of weeks ago, and I'm an absolute fan now. You have to start selling T-shirts.
Okay,
Last night, we had the opportunity to listen to a very wise man talk about Leonardo da Vinci. right. and how his genius touched on so many different fields and
right.
really, you know, created a foundation for thought in many different areas. Did Rutherford's genius touch on other areas, or was he very somewhat monochromatic in just physics and football?
Well, he couldn't paint. No, he was, I mean, I think that my college has the largest collection of Da Vinci memorabilia, at least in the United States, maybe in the world. No, he was not that kind of, he was well-read, was a great historian, great raconteur, but those were not the interests of his life. He loved being in an academic community. When Bohr was his assistant, they were going to dinner. He loved to socialize, too. We're going to dinner at an English professor's house. C.P. Snow tells the story. C.P. Snow was originally educated as a physicist. They were going to him, and Snow said he had read. They were talking about what they had read of this literary fellow's works and how impressed they were by it. But as they got to the front steps, Rutherford said to Bohr, he said, oh, he's a brilliant fellow and he's done wonderful work. He said, occasionally you wonder if he ever wonders why when someone pushes a button at the front of his house, a bell rings in the back. But he could sit all night and talk about Napoleon's wars and whatnot. But he did not do serious work in any of those fields as Da Vinci did.
We have another question over here.
My question is more of a broader nature. It seems to me you've written several biographies now. You've delved deeply in the lives of John F. Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and now scientist Ernest Rutherford. Have you ever thought of any common thread, any common trait, any commonality among all these men that you've written extensively about? Or they are totally different?
Well, two of the presidents, Kennedy and Reagan, shared the kind of inspirational glow that Rutherford exuded. They inspired other people. They were able to bring out the best in other people, even if they couldn't understand it. Nixon obviously was good at bringing out the worst in people. But other than that, I hate to put it this way, presidents are pygmies compared to people like this. They do a very narrow thing, and they may do it, but the internet will have more to do with the way we live and in the human condition than will say George W. Bush would. So that I am a believer in the heroic theory, and that these were the greatest heroes.
Do we have other questions down here in front?
I'm amazed, by the way, in talking about that, because I've spoken here before, and I thought, you know, people come out to hear you talk about a president. I wouldn't have been surprised if I walked in here tonight and was alone. I
would
so
have been
happy.
Here.
Right, the two of us would have. I'm so happy that people care. And I was so happy I was able to do the work. I didn't have to introduce or reintroduce John F. Kennedy to the world, but I have found that I'm lucky enough to try to introduce Ernest Rutherford to the world outside New Zealand and Russia, where he is a national figure. Many things in Russia. One of his assistants, Pyotr Kapitsa, who was a Soviet and was not allowed to come back to England when he left the lab, and was widely believed to be the designer of Sputnik. That has not been proven, but in Russia, which is a great scientific country, Rutherford is considered one of the great men.
You have a question?
I'm curious in terms of, I'm not very good in science, so maybe my question is not science-based, but it seems to me like reading your book and other books that look back in time to scientists who were famous, that despite having less media to cover them, they actually had almost star status. And it seems today that very few people other than a Bill Gates has right. that kind of status. Why is that? We have more means now to know about these people, and science is, if anything, more important now than ever. And it just seems that they're not valued, the ones that are alive today, nor the ones that have passed, other than an Einstein, because he's kind of kooky and
right.
has great hair.
Right.
Can you comment a bit on why you think that's happened?
Rutherford was a great self-promoter, too. I mean, the answer is that and it's not only true in science, our societies are no longer structured for individuals to work in. When you need a million volts, you've got to work with a lot of other people. You're part, particularly in America, you're brought in as part of a team. And I do think that when we're... are Watson and Crick the last... I mean, Watson's got himself in a little... But are Watson and Crick the last celebrated scientists?
Well, I think we have Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking and some of the great cosmologists, but Watson and Crick are...
Yeah, that because I do think the future is in biological work, but it will be very rare, I think, that individuals will be... Because other people are putting up the money, and it takes enormous amounts of money today. Only after he was dead did people at Cambridge discovered, Rutherford was cheap too, that the family, I've forgotten their name, who owned the Orient Express and the shipping line, which was a huge thing, had offered him any amount of money with no conditions, and he turned it down. All he had to do was ask. And he never asked, and Chadwick, who got to know him pretty well, felt that the reason he didn't was he wanted to be alone, but he was not afraid of that they would interfere because they put up the money, but he was afraid he would fail and then have wasted their money, and he did not want to put himself in that position. And he often failed. They all did. There's a great trial and error quality to science.
Failure is an integral part. We have time for one more question. I believe this gentleman here had it. I hope I'm not ignoring people over here. It's hard for me to turn.
I just want to make a quick comment in the fact that you were surprised there are so many people here. It's probably because the respect for you and the books that you've written in the past.
Thank you. I did this for fun, but it was, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Is there one more question? Yes, right there.
None of you thought I had relatives in the audience.
Huh? back to me again. The stamp collecting quote has been one of my favorites for decades, and I've always wondered, do you feel that it was a disparaging comment about the other disciplines, or was he really just saying it really all comes down to how particles interact?
I don't think he was kidding. I think he believed that.
Yeah.
And, of course, one of the great ironies was that he won the Nobel Prize in chemistry because they knew he was quite young, and they had already voted on the physics prize when his discovery of half-life, which is what he actually won the Nobel for, the chemistry prize was open, and he began his lecture in Stockholm by saying that they make the word slips me. That they make fun of alchemy, but the fastest material change I've ever seen is changing me from a physicist to a chemist.
I think that's a great place to end. I want to thank all of you for coming out. I mean, like
I
Richard,
too.
I'm just astonished and delighted that this many people came out for a talk on Rutherford.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.